You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and assuming that the world hasn't ended between now and when this airs, this is the 21st of December, and we're coming to the end of 2022. As always, I say the same things, for my donors and supporters, people on my Patreon, the donation button being the Russian Orthodox Medievalist, that blue button with the double eagle on it, that goes directly to me. People who are buying my book, and apparently the new book, and apparently there's a lot of you, from Amazon, and leaving a whole bunch of reviews. To all of you, I say thank you very much, because I certainly couldn't function without you. If you were to ask me, I don't know why I haven't done this before. I think I just thought I did. If you were to ask me an article that I've written that I'm particularly proud of, there's one going back to 2013. It's been on my website for a while. It was published by the Barnes Review back then. I have never done a broadcast on it. And it is the paper on the Committee for the Organization of Jewish Life, headed by the poet and senator Gabriel Derzhavin in early 19th century Russia. And it's because in English, no one has spoke about this at any length. Any mainstream publication on this is going to have to distort it. You know, as I say all the time, anyone in the mainstream who uses Google and maybe doesn't even know how badly censored everything is, anytime they approach a topic, I don't care what topic it is, they're using maybe, 20, 30% of the available approaches and data. Either because they simply don't know, which I think is the bulk of people, or they have no choice. So that means anything someone in the mainstream writes about, especially of any political or moral significance, it can't be trusted, even if the person is completely honest. Because Americans, for the last 5 to 10 years, especially the last, since 2016 in particular, have been forced to live in a sanitized and censored bubble. They simply don't know what the other point of view is. And this can only be done in the context of tremendous financial and media control. Everything that the regime does, whether it be foreign policy or domestic, diplomatic, international, financial, requires mass public ignorance. I've been saying this for a very long time. Now I'm hearing other people saying it, and I'm happy for that. But everything that the regime does requires mass public ignorance. Now, masses are a specifically modern phenomenon. There were no masses in the Middle Ages. You had estates and classes, not just amorphous semi-individuals. The mass is actually an interesting ontological question. But masses are always ignorant. They have no foundation. That's part of what makes them part of a mass. And left-wing materialist socialism or Marxism refers to masses all the time. They're not referring to actual people. They're referring to people sort of as you would refer to bees in a hive. One particular bee is really pretty meaningless. And so every question comes down to this, and it becomes extremely difficult to deal with people who have simply never heard this stuff, don't know it exists, and have been taught to hate what they clearly don't understand. And it doesn't matter who you're talking to. Obviously, the dominant or predominant example of that is the Jewish question. It's almost impossible to talk about Russian history without talking about the power of the Jews or the Khazars from the Middle Ages to today. And the same thing goes for American politics, Western European politics, obviously Middle Eastern politics. Some societies are more, are freer than others. But to avoid talking about Judaism is impossible. And that's what we're going to talk about today. One of the reasons I like this article in particular is that there is no doubt this completely destroys any apology for Jewish behavior in modern Russia. And I say modern, I mean anything, you know, from Peter the Great on. Peter the Great essentially to Bolshevism. And in a sense, Bolshevism was was clearly a mass phenomenon. And it's important to note that Karl Marx supported unrestrained capitalism and especially free trade, at least for a period of time, partially because he says very clearly, as does Engels, by the way, that it breaks down national and ethnic traditions. Marx needed the destruction of the guilds as much as capitalism did. The point of capitalism is that it's a revolutionary ideology. And of course, is almost identical to materialist socialism on almost everything. And it's really just a matter of degree. Now it is indistinguishable. Soviet Leninism and postmodern liberalism in America are indistinguishable, including the constant use of physical force and threats. The difference being, of course, that, they're identical in every respect. It's just that, as a matter of fact, the Soviets didn't have access to the technological grid that postmoderns do. And this is all a very important introduction, because once you read this, and in this case, hearing it, you can never, you can just be dishonest. I think, you know, a lot of intellectuals are just dishonest. They have come across this stuff before and can't act like they have. But once you read this, you will never understand Russian history in the same way. So, what's this all about? The Jewish question in particular was specifically and gently addressed under two Russian emperors. That is Great Paul, who's been canonized, and Alexander I, who certainly has not. I've dealt with both of these men many times in the past. And this is the son and grandson, respectively, of Catherine II. So the Committee for the Organization of Jewish Life, I think, is the most standard English translation. Sometimes I call it the Jewish Commission, under the famous poet Gavrila Derzhavin, or Gabriel Derzhavin. The point of this was to alleviate the condition of the Jews in the newly incorporated and relatively wealthy parts of what today we would call Western Russia. And I wrote here, I said, what they discovered, instead of that, changed Russian opinion on the Jewish question forever. And of course, this is almost completely unknown. Other than me, the only other accessible treatment of this is in Solzhenitsyn's 200 Years Together. And I think this is where I first heard of it. I cite him a few times, and then I expanded on it. Even in Russia, it's mentioned. Friends of mine have mentioned it, but it's even there. It's not as well known as it should be. Now, let me give you the background here a little bit. At the end of the 18th century, Russian Empire had changed radically, especially in their primary antagonist, Poland. Poland-Lithuania fell apart. And I've dealt with that at great length as to the relationship between both Judaism and oligarchy on the one hand, and then that's connection to the fall of Poland on the other. Now, the Polish Empire took Russian, Ukrainian-speaking areas. Most of the eastern lands of that empire, even calling it an empire is a problem because it was completely privatized, were part of the old Kievan state. Between 1772 and 1795, these areas were reabsorbed into the Russian Empire. Now, that means the Russian Empire now is ruling over the overwhelming majority of the world's Jewish population. And this all got started where Emperor Paul, St. Paul of all Russia, who was murdered in 1801, was getting concerned for the constant peasant riot in Russian Orthodox riots in these newly annexed lands. Now, this is what you have to understand as far as this period of time, as well as the pogrom myth at the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century. These were fairly wealthy areas. The czars were absolutely obsessed with making sure that they remained peaceful. They needed to be developed, incorporated into the Russian Empire, because that means a huge boost in the empire's GDP. To have violence here was simply out of the question. And in fact, it would make absorbing these areas pointless. It would then cost them more than they'd be getting. It's a similar argument for the nonsense about China and Xinjiang against the Uyghurs, who, of course, no one's ever heard of before. Violence against them is laughable because this is exactly the area and the region that the Chinese government is trying to develop and incorporate properly into the Han-dominated Chinese society. Violence and persecution doesn't make any sense. People are so bereft of even basic critical thinking that they don't understand that oppression is extremely difficult, it costs a lot of money, and could be a wedge between the ruling class and the army. So it's all a very, and my paper and my talks on the pogroms, which very few people have dealt with in the past, I also got that from Solzhenitsyn. It's all the same thing. Russia wanted to profit from these fairly wealthy areas of the former Polish Empire, Poland-Lithuania. Having violence, especially deliberately created violence, would make it extremely costly and it would be worthless to incorporate them. So the inquest started with worrying about these riots. The Russian Orthodox, Ukrainian, even Polish peasants who were brought into the Russian Empire hated the Jewish elite. Now, no one knew why. It had been a long time since the Russian Empire really had a large Jewish population. And really, it began with a Philo-Semitic approach. Because initially, everyone thought that this was just irrational. They're projecting all their problems onto this group of people. So the inquest, as I said, was called the Committee for the Organization of Jewish Life under two rulers, Paul and Alexander. Both committees, actually, all of this was chaired by Derzhavin. Remember, he was a member of the Imperial Senate as well, and one of Russia's best-known poets behind Pushkin. But let me read you, and I got this from in Russian from Katasonov, and he published this in 1993. I've done a whole talk on him. And this is the Senate's draft of the purpose of this mission. And they say it was to work to discover the cause of the financial complaint from peasants and the nature of their livelihood. These complaints are to the detriment of agriculture and economic life, generally in areas where Jews live. This committee will deal with these issues and seek funds to remedy the present situation of the Jews. They did not go into this assuming that the peasants were right. A lot of these peasants weren't Russian. They were all Slavs, maybe a handful of Germans, but they were not Russian. They simply weren't sure. They went in, the bias going in, especially when they chose Dyrshavin, was that the Jews were victims. They knew that the Jews were fairly wealthy, and they didn't want that upset, no different than the Poles wanted it upset centuries earlier. And of course, more importantly than all that, Russia required civic peace in areas that are not used to coming under Russian control. Over and over again, both Paul and Alexander stressed objectivity. This is about solutions, not ideology. Simply put, Emperor Paul wanted to incorporate these populations, very naively, into Russia without creating friction. What a lot of these guys saw was money and wealth that could be used, forgetting Russia's already terrible history with the successors of Khazaria. But making matters more difficult is, as I already hinted, that it's an ethnically mixed region. You had some Cossacks there, Ukrainians, Poles, Germans, Jews, Russians, Magyars, and Czechs, in greater or lesser numbers. So these are Westerners. This is why the emperors needed to tread very carefully. They wanted smooth sailing and commerce, opening up more windows with corporations to the west, and any violence was out of the question. The whole point of taking these areas in was economic. And it really, you have to admit, as great as Paul was, it's very naive to think that they could simply be brought in within the Kahal system to the empire with no problem. It's ridiculous. There was a sense of mission here that we can finally, you know, they could have self-government and do as they please, but there's something wrong with the peasants out there. There's a problem, and we need objective data as to find out why. The Baltic grain trade was always very profitable. This, among many other things, is why peace was so absolutely important. So you have both a security issue and an economic necessity. And it's even more dire than that, as I've said many times elsewhere. Remember the era that we're in here. Revolutionary France is still a thing. And they, later Napoleon, sought an alliance with Polish elites. So you're talking about a violent revolution against the empire in regions that were just brought into it. So this is a serious, extremely delicate situation. So for these commissions, the one under Paul, the one under Alexander, the purpose was to get a view of class relations, estate relations, economic relations of the area. And, you know, believe it or not, the idea was to assist Jews in their transition from Polish to Russian rule. You know, believing that that could be done. This is part of why these areas were annexed. They were annexed because they were very well off. Rather than having a confrontational approach with the Kahal, Emperor Paul wanted at least a profitable coexistence. But this also meant that peasants, whether Orthodox or not, were also to be listened to get a fair hearing. They're not rioting for nothing. So, of course, these two purposes are closely related. And Dyrshavin personally, I've translated at least one letter from him, that his motivation was clipping the wings of the Polish aristocracy, not the Jews. If you were to ask Paul or Alexander who the threat is there, it's the anti-Russian oligarchs that, you know, the successors of those families, Pataki and many others, that made up the Polish Empire. So that means you have three groups here, at least three groups. You have the native peasantry in that region, you have the Jewish Kahal, and you have the oligarchs formally making up the parliament in Poland. And believe it or not, this is something that even Solzhenitsyn didn't understand, that Jews were seen as somehow employees of the Poles rather than the other way around. The point of it all is there is a tremendous necessity here. Peace was the primary concern, and they're going into this, if anything, with a Philo-Semitic approach. But this naivete was going to be dispelled very, very shortly. And it had the commission itself had was a pretty diverse group of people. You had Senator Pataki, of course, who's Polish. Czartoryski, another one, who was a deputy interior minister. Kotrubey, who was the actual minister of the interior. This is the core of the committee, and it's important to note that none of them are Russian, except for Dzhavin himself. The Pataki family, as I mentioned, they were part of this so-called Jewish empowerment. The Polish Empire relied very heavily on its urban Jewish population. To show how concerned they were with objectivity, both Pataki and Czartoryski were both families very close to both Polish oligarchic interests on the one hand and elite Jewish power on the other. It's not an exaggeration to say that the Polish Empire was essentially Judaic, because that was the source of financing that went back to the 13th century as this empire began to develop. So, because modern, postmodern theorists are going to try to claim, well, they're Russians and Poles, therefore they hate Jews for no reason, here you have a deliberate attempt to create a commission that in no way could be considered anti-Judaic. And it should, and I wrote this in the article itself, some of these families are old enemies of the Russian Empire. I mean, Poland was the main competitor for centuries, and warfare and everything else. The fact that they had been brought into the empire and made senators shows exactly how the Russian Empire viewed these ethnic relations, and it's a very Roman thing to do. Yes, they've been defeated. They've been a part of Russian life for some time, but you don't kill them. You raise them up and make them loyal. Now, getting to know the role of the Jews in this part of the world, I went to a few sources. A guy by the name of Anatoly Muchek, who's Jewish, and he's writing in the Ukrainian language newspaper, Ukrainian Choice. And he says this is written in 2013. Traditionally, Jews were typically usurers, since more respectable occupations were not available to them, including the right to own land. There's no doubt that Jews were dishonest in their dealings, it has to be admitted, because of the tax burdens laid on them. They required more income due to this. They had to figure any and all ways to make more money. Under the monarchy, they had to avoid all quote-unquote malicious occupations, such as owning liquor stores and bars, and they had to become useful members of society. Now, this is a Jewish writer, okay? His comments are important, but they're only half true. To think that Jews played no role prior to this in the Russian Empire is as absurd as anything else. Some of the more powerful financiers of the Russian Empire were Jews. I mentioned the Bulyakov, Ginsburg, Anoikin, and the Peretz families. Now, as the 19th century came to a close, and this is, you know, obviously 100 years when we're talking about, they were involved in buying up sugar plantations in Ukraine. They were some of the financiers of Russian railroads, and they also bought up the gold mines, the most famous of which was the Lena Gold Works that actually was going to play a role in the revolution. So off the bat, Jews were, as they always are, a privileged group of people here. Jews were landowners all over the place. there were no laws restricting Jewish land ownership unless it came from the Kahal itself. The Kahal is the Jewish community, commune, which were allowed to function by all Central European empires. But any prohibition, any attack on Jewish ownership of land wouldn't really have mattered anyway, since the Kahal was not subject to the laws of any empire and was totally self-governing. The Jewish ownership of land developed, at least partially, because the earlier Polish lords, even some of the later ones, powerful Polish oligarchic families, were both illiterate and loathed any kind of commercial dealings, which is a typical aristocratic point of view. So centuries earlier, the Polish noble clans granted their business and financial dealings to Jews. Therefore, even if it was blatantly proscribed, you had mountains of de facto land ownership by Jews, and it became the norm. So the relation between Jews and Poles in the Polish Empire, those relations are, we have to deal with them. They're equally important as the Russian version. And I've spoke about this elsewhere, several places, in fact. But let's summarize it. Let's summarize it very briefly. Polish nobles, and I really want to say oligarchs. I'm not saying they were Catholic and all that stuff, but they became quite vulgar. So these noble families, remember, there really was no powerful monarchy. The entire purpose of the noble clans and parliament was to control the monarch. And if the monarch became too powerful, they would destroy him, even at great expense. Many Polish monarchs won battles against the Turks, for example. They were usually overthrown. Because, as we all know, nothing solidifies someone in power like a huge military victory. But beyond that, these oligarchs hired Jews to collect taxes. They held their leases. They financed whatever they needed. And they protected the aristocratic assets, almost like a very powerful accountant. Accountant and lawyer combined. But there were more than that. By 1620, in the Polish Empire, Jews had full de facto control of the empire's economy. And this is with the express permission of the aristocracy. Now, why is that? And it's something that kind of makes Poland unique in this respect. The Kahal was given, these Jews were given privileges, up to and including exemption from taxation, so as to keep the commerce of the cities from becoming something that the Polish crown can use, for like the early British Empire, British monarchs did. That alliance between the commercial city on the one hand and the crown on the other hand against the aristocracy. But with a handful of exceptions, the Polish crown was almost a powerless figure. And this, when it comes down to it, is why Poland was now being dismembered. Because Poland was now surrounded by centralized states, comparatively speaking, and they were really, to some extent, incapable of concerted action. They had confederations where their big families would get together for a specific purpose, and that's pretty much what Polish policy was. Normally, we study the development of European monarchies. It is usually based on the alliance, as I say, of mercantile cities, low-level nobles, and the church. The upper aristocracy was never an ally of the crown. They were almost always an enemy of the crown. Because, as I wrote at the time, these elites, and we're talking about the most powerful, the Polish, not just in Poland, I mean everywhere, France and Britain, that these powerful families were consistently the most unrelenting antagonists to royal centralization. This has everything to do with the killing of the king. The nature of liberalism and revolution comes from this constant battle. You have historians so stupid that they really believe, let's say when they're talking about the French Revolution, that the upper nobles and the crown were on the same side. You know, it's like they were born yesterday. But in the Polish case, to keep that kind of alliance from happening, to benefit the crown, the noble families then imported Khazars to dominate commerce at all levels. So now the crown can't use it. The Kahal will be dependent on the protection of the powerful Polish clans. On the one hand, they can keep an eye on them. They can possibly control them. And it's completely outside, on the other, the scope of the crown. From 1580 to 1772, Poland was an oligarchic republic. Calling it a monarchy is falsehood. And it seemed that from this period of time, this alliance of the noble class and the Jews, this alliance was totally unbreakable. They were very consistent here. There was no standing army in Poland. And as I say, it's these confederations, noble confederations, who mustered their own troops. The military, in other words, was under these landed magnates. On the one hand, finance was in Jewish hands on the other. I called this at the time a fiendish coalition. And the true victims were the peasants and the crown. It's funny, all my works, all my books and articles on this topic, generally speaking, the Polish crown was not anti-Russian. But the Kahal certainly was, and the Polish elite certainly were. Polish serfdom, as a result of all this, was the harshest and simply the worst form of exploitation possibly in European history. I mentioned this in my very first book when I was 29, The Third Rome. This is why the serfdom there was so harsh. The Kahal was put in charge of the condition of the peasantry. Now, that's the background. You can't understand anything else unless you know that history. In other words, the Polish Empire was both oligarchic and heavily Judaic. 80%, at least 80% of the Jewish population in the world between 1580 and 1772 was in the Polish Empire. God knows, now it's part of the Russian Empire. But Paul and so many others really believe that if they just handle this properly and give all the proper assurances, the Kahal will work in their favor. Yeah, of course, you had individual Jewish families that did do wonderful things for the Russian monarchy. That's true. But I am telling you they were a minority. Now, Dzerzhavin being sent to what we call West Russia, he wrote several essays that, bound together, became his opinion. And these articles were his first impressions of the situation between the peasants and Jews and oligarchs in the Western newly annexed parts of Central Europe. I also went to Vladimir Kozyakov, who was writing in the journal Union, Soyuz, the Belarusian journal, actually. And it's a secondary source on this issue. And I'm quoting him directly now. He wrote this in 2014. This is what Dzerzhavin discovered, and we know this from his opinion. Arriving in Belarus in the summer of 1800, the senator was struck by the condition of the peasants. They were hungry and malnourished, yet their barns were full of grain. He quickly ordered the distribution of this produce from the possession of the Polish prince Jan Ogniski. He informed Emperor Paul that he had taken the names of all the offending landlords who were deliberately starving peasants. Stopping a cart in Vitebsk, owned by powerful Jewish merchants from Krichau, full of grain and flour. He sent it back to the landlord and distributed its contents to the peasants. He forced landlords to make permanent adjustments to their exploitative way of living. And that's from the Belarusian journal, Union Soyuz. That's Dzerzhavin's first impression. Now, one abuse that he mentions in the early essays of the opinion was the fact that both Poles and Jews were granting peasants only short-term leases. In other words, the Jews would draw it up, get, you know, rubber stamp approval from the oligarch, and then go and use oligarchic forces to enforce it. So these short-term leases existed so as to be able to raise the rent in the near future. If they're locked in for a 20-year lease, there's not much you can do legally. There probably is. You know, who's going to do anything? But now in the empire, there is someone who can do something. The point was to exploit them. They'd even start low, knowing full well that in a very short time, they're going to double it. So Dzerzhavin, his first demand was that leases be at a minimum 9 years, and that all stipulations will be enforced or will enforce them. Another thing that he noted right away was the Jewish domination of the vodka trade. They had a monopoly, in fact, a government-enforced monopoly on vodka. And from some of this, he wanted to see more fundamental changes in how wealth was distributed. Now, the Third Rome was prefaced on one argument. Now, the Third Rome, that book, was really an outline of the rest of my scholarly life. And the foundation was that only a very strong monarchy or military government had the power and the objectivity to force the rich to share some of the wealth. They have no incentive to enforce contracts to the extent it benefited anyone but themselves. But when you don't have a government that's tightly controlled by oligarchs, like you have in the U.S. and London, everywhere else, they have an advocate. This was the case in Germany, in Prussia under the monarchy, and in Russia as the Tsar became, relatively speaking, centralized. Dzerzhavin, and one of the reasons he was chosen for this, he was a man of high standards. Even his opponents, because needless to say, Dzerzhavin became very unpopular in certain circles, his idealism and his good-naturedness was never challenged. And that was at the time, as well as today. His opinion, therefore, had tremendous weight. But just given this opinion, his first set of essays, his first impressions, already Poles and Jews were panicking. Someone is coming to find them out. So here's what Dzerzhavin says. I translated this myself, which sometimes I struggle with, especially when it's older like this. Here's what he says. Many different opinions on the Jews have been given. I find that the Kahal to be a nest of hatred and subversion of Christianity. These organizations are effective and well-funded. In Prussia, they've been destroyed. They serve no one but themselves, making their money from liquor is based on it being used as a lure. Few can refuse. The legal device of the Hazaka is a way for them to keep in their hands control over peasant land in perpetuity. Hedemi is a cover for atrocities to the detriment of all local commerce. And Koldov, an impervious, profane concealment of the most horrifying barbarities to the detriment of public and private life, it is a method of proficient thievery. Now, that I quoted from Solzhenitsyn 200 years together, where I first discovered this. I don't know, it probably is in English now, but at the time I struggled to translate it. I think Dzerzhavin is very difficult, being a poet. The names that I dropped here, they're not proper names. Zaka, Irmi, and Kolodov. These are methods. I think these have Yiddish roots. For they're devices used to exploit others. And let me describe them here briefly. These terms were discovered by Drozdovin. He didn't even know what they were. He had to go asking around. Hazki and Helmi were ways of stealing the property of others and then legally legitimizing it. So Hazki is the taking of symbolic land ownership. And it was a means of getting around any law against it. Private property had no meaning there. The latter, Helmi, this is how they void all contracts made with the peasantry, or really any non-Jew. Ultimately, it comes down to these being arcane tricks that neither the peasants nor the oligarchs understood. But since the economy was almost entirely in Jewish hands, and the Kahal was totally autonomous, these legal scams were actually pretty simple on the day-to-day level. Now, he also found out what Kulidov means. It's very insidious. It was the practice. I mean, it seems so simple to us, but it was common. It's where they got peasants drunk at harvest time. It has to be harvest time because that's when they had money. And then they would entice them in that condition to take out larger loans at extremely high rates. So the issue here, this isn't what Drozdovin wanted to bring back to Petersburg. Since Jews were the middlemen of the Polish economy, and had de facto control over pretty much anything liquid, to solve the problems of the peasantry and the riots, you had, you know, he's one of two options. Either you expropriate the Jews or somehow assimilate them. When Emperor Paul found out about this, he wanted to develop a third option, and that is he wanted to settle them on the land as small proprietors. And again, there's a little bit of naivete here. But of course, he got over that pretty quickly since all of them, all Jews refused this. Of course, the life of a peasant was not exactly as profitable as the parasitic life they were leading. The Jews made their money gouging peasants and even sometimes an occasional low-level lord. Because, as we all know, the Catholic or Orthodox peasantry is seen by the Jews as mere cattle to be manipulated. In Solzhenitsyn's 200 Years Together, this is mostly part one. Solzhenitsyn's dealing mostly with the 20th century, but he does have a few introductory sections. And and not only did he inform me about these commissions, but what they discovered. And actually, Solzhenitsyn reprints Drozdovin's opinion in full. And it's not been translated. This is, you know, I wrote this many years ago. At the time, I didn't think it had been translated into English. Here's something else Drozdovin writes. Landlords, having granted Jews a monopoly over alcohol sales, worked together to the point where the peasants had very little. This, and Jews as powerful tax farmers, brought peasants to poverty, forcing peasants to take one loan to pay another off. Half of peasant income was easily taken away this way, while peasant incomes would otherwise have given them a prosperous livelihood. And that's extremely important. These are wealthy areas. There was a lot of money to be made in the Baltic grain trade. A lot of peasants would have done well as small, medium-sized landholders, but there was a coalition, a very powerful coalition, that was keeping them from doing that. In parts of the Polish Empire that, in fact, were Ukrainian, one of the most obnoxious elements of this was Jewish ownership of Orthodox parishes. I mean, the building and the land, physically. Now, despite their illiteracy, the Polish nobility was very Roman Catholic. So, and I said at the time, and I said many other times since, that when you have two very different religions, two related but very different ethnicities, it makes exploiting them much easier. The farmer was religiously, ethnically, and culturally alien. I've noted this in America, too, where, given that the small farmer's life has been totally destroyed, you had to reduce them to ignorant rednecks in order to justify it. Then no one feels guilty, because they don't deserve to own anything. It's very hard to exploit your own people, and that was the nature of so-called serfdom in the Russian Empire. These were not foreigners. So there were few, actually, by this time, there were a few Orthodox parishes in eastern or southern Poland, that is to say, you know, part of Ukraine. The few that existed were sealed up, and they wouldn't open it until the Jewish leaseholder was given a substantial fee. And among other things, but why? Because this is probably the most noxious part of the Jewish oligarchy. The peasantry, especially the East Slavic peasantry, within this area, was a very efficient cultivator, just like the American farmer was incredibly productive. But their efficiency didn't benefit them. See, Central European serfdom in this period of time got its roots in the Renaissance, this spike in Western populations. Growth of the money economy and urban development brought the demand for grain to see massive increases, and prices continued to go up. Therefore, in Poland, taking advantage of that required this obnoxious coalition. Now, what this means in practice is that grain grown in Slavic areas then was exported by a Jewish network, and that network was headquartered in several cities: Antwerp, Constantinople, there was Istanbul at the time, Krakow, and London. And I said at the time they had satellite branches in Spain, even Amsterdam, and then Petersburg, unfortunately. This is the network. This is the source of Jewish power, because this permitted Jewish bankers to secure interest rates at first far lower than anyone else. They had more access to liquidity. At first, these rates were irresistible. So if a Jewish elite wants to grant a tremendous advantage to somebody, he would use those much lower rates, and whoever he is supporting would be very well off by comparison. That tremendous network, they had so much liquidity at their disposal, they could afford to have very low rates. Now, Dzerzhavin continues here. And he's talking about poorer Jews in this case. The simple poorer Jews are blinded and dazzled by other Jews so that an imperishable partition is created. They are surrounded by superstition such that they remained a unified society. Children learn from the Talmud, which protects the position of the wealthy. The Talmud gives us no hope in the eventual change of manners. In other words, the Talmud is such that trying to change their minds on things is going to be impossible. Now, here's what he says concerning the Kahal. He says, their income is far greater than what they pay tax on, and Kahal elders will never turn over any records. The poor live in extreme want, while the Kahal rulers live in abundance, having great power over the simple people. Of course, we all know what that is. Dzerzhavin saw poor Jews as victims of the Kahal, no more, you know, no less than anybody else. And very soon, obviously he's a very literate man, he picked up very quickly, as a very sharp person, that the Talmud mystified the power of the rabbis. It justified their rule. They were constantly depicted, they do it today, of course, they depict all Gentiles as savage beasts, not only to rationalize exploitation, but also keeping poor Jews fearful. If you believe that leaving the Kahal is going to mean your automatic death, control is very easy for the rabbis to maintain. So the Kahal victimized peasants, occasional low-level nobles, and their less wealthy members. So it is an evil institution. So, with all this, Dzerzhavin was slandered. Once his opinion was published, he was scathed. Let me quote a few things here. There's one Jewish newspaper, a local Jewish newspaper, called him the leader of Russian anti-Semites. And Dzerzhavin, of course, was punished for exposing what had been a hidden form of exploitation. Neither Paul nor Alexander had any preconceived notions of Jews. Now, things would change later. And there was no prejudice. The very existence of this committee proves that. Dzerzhavin among them all, had no animus against Jews. But this is why I say these fact-finding missions changed the Russian point of view on the Jews forever. The modern Russian Empire, here we're talking about 1800, 1805, Russia didn't have the experience, I say maybe the Germans or the Poles did, in dealing with this very well-organized, very well-off, and very Machiavellian Jewish Kahal system. Now, Emperor Paul wanted to resettle them, as I said. That's the third option that he came up with. It was only partially carried out, mostly because he was murdered soon after, so we consider him a martyr. And after he was killed by the oligarchs in Petersburg, Alexander reorganized the commission, that is to say, Alexander I. He did not accept, however, the resettlement idea, making them small landowners. So you had a second committee, and the second committee came from something very specific. It came from Napoleon's desire to restore what he called the Sanhedrin in the Middle East under his protection. This is a very early proto-Zionist idea, which meant automatically that the leaders of the Kahal will become enemies of any rival to the French emperor. You know, Napoleon was Philo-Semitic, and the Jews responded to him positively. So if Jews in the former Polish lands were satisfied with Russian rule, they'd have no reason to serve Napoleon. So maybe it's not so naive after all. Trying to keep the peace here and absorb these Jews without too much trouble, you had the problem of Napoleon behind it. Again, Alexander was naive too. He wanted, like Paul, to ensure a loyal Jewish presence in Western Russia. Now, the second committee, I quoted the order for the, you know, the purpose of the first committee. The second committee, the order says that this committee ought to carefully consider the proposals of Derzhavin and make observations on the improvement of Jews, not only in Belarus, but also in other regions purchased from Poland, as well as the provinces of the south, end quote. So we're talking about not only the southern regions, what we would call, you know, Ukraine, the Polish Empire, but also the Belarusian or former lands of one time controlled by Lithuania. But essentially, the Tsars viewed it all, you know, essentially as one entity. So once Derzhavin published his opinion, the Kahals, or the first actions of the Kahals in West Russia, they threatened a ban on any Jew cooperating with this committee. Europe's Jews, once his first report, the opinion, came out, they were extremely agitated. And when Derzhavin made a second trip to Poland and Belarus, they were extremely anxious. The Kahal system sent over 1 million rubles to St. Petersburg. They wanted Derzhavin off this committee, and they were willing to bribe whoever they could. Money poured into Petrograd from Jews throughout Europe. I mean, even Kotchubey was offered massive sums of money. Then Alexander invited the Kahal, the main Kahal in Minsk, in Belarus, to come to St. Petersburg and give their point of view. So you had two Jewish bankers in Petersburg, Notkin and Abram Peretz. These two became the point men for Jewish control over the second commission. Their purpose was to bribe anyone they could to do two things. First, to rewrite the opinion of Derzhavin to make it more accommodating to Jewish interests. And second, that Derzhavin be removed. And they were willing to pay ridiculous sums for this. Notkin actually visited Derzhavin in his office and offered him 200,000 rubles to rewrite his report. Derzhavin kind of already knew this. He angrily refused. Now, Alexander, in a gesture of good faith, fired Derzhavin from his post in 1803, just 2 years after Paul's mysterious murder. Hence, Derzhavin has the distinction of being one of a select handful of politicians in history who were punished for refusing to take a bribe. But at least in the short term, it worked. But since the Second Committee permitted the continuation of the Jewish monopoly in liquor, which was a long-standing complaint of peasants in the church in Western Russia, In fact, writer Paul Skakun, the Cahal had full support of the state once the so-called pliable grandson of Catherine II was in power. They took advantage of Alexander. After the murder of Paul by the oligarchs, unquestionably at the behest of elite moneyed interests, Alexander unfortunately became much easier to manipulate. He appointed Mikhail Speransky, it's a fairly well-known name, to finish the work of the Second Commission, which was something that Cahal really wanted to hear. Speransky was fairly liberal. He was a high-ranking Freemason. So now, as opposed to what it was under Paul, the Second Commission is now made up of mostly pro-Judaic elements. Derzhavin became the Minister of Justice and not directly involved in Jewish affairs. The clear policy of keeping him away from these affairs caused his resignation in 1803. He retired. He wrote some of his best work. He died in 1812. But the continued impoverishment of Ukrainian and Belarusian peasants never stopped. Let me quote Solzhenitsyn here and his opinion in the matter. The Second Committee included magnates, Adam Sartorsky, Potocki, Severin, Zubov, and others who owned large estates in Poland and were closely associated with the Jews. Derzhavin, along with Speransky, were on the committee. The committee invited Jewish deputies from all provincial kahals and prominent Jews, including Notkin and tax farmer Abram Peretz and their employees. Of course, he wrote this, and then Derzhavin was fired. So of the two commissions, the first under Paul was the only one that had a chance for any kind of rational solution to the Jewish problem. Their arrogance, the fraudulent practices, and the ignorance of the Polish nobility were ruining the peasantry there, and hence harming the Russian economy. You would expect an insurrection against this, and it received very little redress. Paul was one of the great rulers of the very early 19th century. There's a journal, Orthodox America, wrote in 1985. This is what they said about Paul. The dreams which this idealist Orthodox monarch had conceived during the lone and often frustrating period before he ascended the throne were destined to be thwarted by the prevailing attitude of a degenerate nobility which had long forsaken the best interest of a holy Russia to which the new Tsar was committed. Paul realized that only an iron hand could save Russia from the brink of disaster to which it had been brought by Catherine the Great. At the same time, he felt keenly the opposition of the pampered nobility. Of course, they don't bother to mention this pampered nobility often came from the West and was being financed by the Cahal. I mean, the Emperor Paul, he forced the elites, the oligarchs, to pay taxes. He forced them, even the highest elites, to suffer the same judicial penalties as even the lowliest peasant. Equality under the law was an outrage to these people. Now, you know, if you've been listening to me for any length of time, I have spent an awful lot of time on the 18th century in Russia. It was a dark time. The only worst time was the 20th century. This was almost a proto-Bolshevik movement here. I used to make fun of, you know, Catherine I, a serf girl captured by Peter and essentially was a sex slave of the army. She reigned as Emperor Catherine I, which is Empress Catherine I, which was a sick joke. But what it meant was that the Russian state then was under an oligarchy of the powerful noble families, such as Menshikov. The only thing Catherine cared about, it's not Catherine the Great, of course, it's Catherine I. The only thing she cared about is dresses and just a complete irrelevancy. But they looted the treasury in Catherine's name. And the same thing for Anna of Courland, Anna Leopoldovna. The middle of the 18th century came to power from this very clique of oligarchs, which meant in practice that both the German and a Masonic nobility ran the Russian state. And I say then and I say now that the Russian state ceased to exist until the rise of Empress Elizabeth, who many of you know I'm a big fan of. I mean, comparatively speaking. Now, from Peter I to Peter III, so almost the entire 18th century, the church came under attack. Half of the Orthodox parishes in the empire were shut down, as was more than two-thirds of the monasteries. Some of my favorite saints were those who resisted this, saints Arseniy of Rostov and Paul of Tobolsk, were thrown in prison and starved. The Bolsheviks were not the first to attempt the liquidation of the church. Oligarchic rule meant the intensification of serfdom, as the monastic lands, where peasants were tenants, not serfs, were forcibly given to oligarchs. Now, I say all this because this is actually important background. The formerly free peasants of Ukraine were forced into serfdom under Catherine II. The Cossack counter-revolutionary center in Zaporozhye was shut down. That town is better known today. When Orthodox peasants violently revolted against noble Polish and Jewish rule in the Kuliwyszyna, starting in the 1760s, Catherine sent troops to quash it, believe it or not, saying that they had a divine obligation to work for their Polish and Jewish lords. There's a reason this was called the Golden Age of the Russian nobility. It was, in fact, an oligarchy of foreigners in St. Petersburg. The worst consequence, though, was that common Russians began to lose faith in the monarchy. This was their potent source of loyalty at one point, but now they saw it as a foreign, Masonic, cosmopolitan institution. Paul, like most Russians, hated his mother, Catherine II. He reversed some of this. He released many of the political criminals that the enlightened Catherine the Great had thrown in the dungeon. He spent a bit of his own fortune opening peasant schools in hundreds of villages. He banned Freemasonry. And that ideology had seeped into the very high reaches of the aristocracy. But because of these female emperors, Catherine I, the two Annas, Catherine II, of course the exception of Elizabeth, he forbade women from ever becoming rulers again. What Paul wanted, and what any rational monarch wanted, especially in the 19th century, he wanted to create a class of peasant yeomen within the commune, but still smallholder. He made it easy for peasants to complain against their lords, and the serfs were subsidized to buy noble land. Now, once they learned of the grain profits accruing to Jews and other elites through the Baltic ports, Paul used state power to lower the price of bread. So there was no oligarchic faction of the elite that he did not irritate. His reform program would, had he not been murdered by these people, would have restored Russia to its older form, where nobles actually had to serve the state. That's why a noble exists. That's the point. Otherwise, there's no reason for the noble class. Of course, they murdered him in 1801, bringing Alexander to power. In Dyrzhavin's opinion, as I said, he argued that the Talmud, and he interviewed Jews all over the place, peasants, merchants. This is what made the simple Jews hate everyone else. The basic view is that when their so-called Messiah comes, all the wealth of the world will accrue to them. So, of course, under the Polish system, it's no shock that these messianic ideas flourished. But, of course, the Cossack rebellions under Khmelnytsky and his successors and the decimation of the Jews in Poland showed some of these prophecies to be a little premature and optimistic. The Jewish yoke hung over the head of the peasants as an unproductive burden. Increasing interest, compounded over decades, ensured that no one, including some of the nobles, would ever get out of debt. The nobility of Poland were usually totally ignorant of their own financial condition, saw their Jewish friends as enforcers. That's the community of interest here. And the price was the destruction of the state in the 1790s. Dyrzhavin was writing at a time when his fellow nobles didn't seem to have much of a role. Being liberated from service by the corrupt Catherine II, there was no justification of their existence. And they were being redefined. The purpose was moral elevation. But seeing what was occurring in Western Russia, this noble class became parasites, not state servants. Westernization just meant greater expenditures, these facades of cosmopolitanism, justifications for their own power. Of course, the upper levels of the nobility in Russia were extremely liberal. They despised monarchy. Every leftist movement throughout this period had strong noble influence. And Dyrzhavin himself was removed exclusively through Jewish bribery. Their power was unchecked. And it's important to note that even mainstream writers realized that the high-level Russian aristocracy was Masonic. So this haggard nonsense myth of the conservative noble needs to be destroyed. Of course, there were exceptions. But that's not how it worked at the time. The urban elites that eventually, one of the reasons he left his second job, the Ministry of Justice, was that these elites were anti-royal, they were Masonic, and they were revolutionary. Like all urban revolutions, and revolutions tend to be urban, the upper class, believing that traditional forms of authority do not promote their interests as they should, created something along the lines of liberalism to challenge it. These slogans of liberty and the rights of man and free trade, these are just the rhetorical weapons used against the agrarian class, the commune, the yeomanry. So if you're an individualist, what it comes down to is that word means that whoever has the most money and influence, when these liberal policies are enacted, whoever has the money and influence automatically wins. They're already ahead of the line. But it also meant that the Jewish network now was unchecked. And it continues to this very day. I'm sorry, I've gone over my time a little bit, but it's very important to note that these impressions, the opinion, and many other writings from Derjavin on this topic, and the objectivity of the commission, the committee, show the violent, immoral, antichrist nature of the Jews in Western Russia, whether it be Poland or Belarus. There's no getting around it. These are facts. And of course, it will be officially denied, and people like Derzhov, of course, are going to be fired over and over again, no matter how positive their intentions are. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.